Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good Wednesday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up this hour, we'll wade into the debate over who the state attorney general is allowed to sue and under what circumstances. And Arizonans may have a new place to apply for medical marijuana.
But first, with a formal impeachment inquiry into President Trump now moving forward, Arizona's congressional delegates are taking sides and joining the colleagues to either bolster or condemn the latest move by the Democratic majority in the House to take action against the president. District 8's Republican Representative Debbie Lesko sounded off on her Democratic colleagues following House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's announcement, describing the decision and the long road to this point simply irritating.
The Democrats are so obsessed about taking out Donald Trump that you can't deal with the normal issues that Americans want us to do.
Just as some, largely in the GOP, have said it is still early days in this latest chapter of the Trump administration, Lesko accused Democrats of pursuing an inquiry before they and the rest of the country have all the facts.
They are trying anything and everything. They don't even have the full story on this Ukrainian whistleblower stuff, and they're still calling for impeachment. It's just amazing to me.
The tone on the left, though, has been very different. Some Democrats, particularly on the more progressive wing of the party, had called for impeachment even before the call with Ukraine was revealed. Representative Ruben Gallego of Phoenix was among those who supported impeachment before today, and he joins us now. Congressman, good morning.
Good morning.
Was there anything about these revelations with the call and with Ukraine that sort of made a difference to you? You had been sort of in favor of impeachment before this. Did the Ukraine situation matter to you at that point?
Well, it certainly does. Look, the president is acting like he is some sort of mobster, extorting a foreign country for political favors, while at the same time withholding appropriated funds from Congress that was supposed to go to the Ukraine. And then, to kind of add a topper to that, he's trying to involve his personal lawyer as well as the Attorney General of the United States in this effort to fabricate political points against a presidential candidate. This is just outright wrong. And a Republican doesn't see this as being outright wrong. It's just being partisan and backing the president for partisan reasons. President Trump, President Bush, or any president had done this before, we all would have been calling for his impeachment. It's ridiculous that the Republican Party has just stooped this low.
What do you see in the transcript that was released this morning of that call?
Well, I mean, I think it's not just the call. I mean, he actually admitted to it also publicly in his remarks to the TV 2 days ago. But what you see in the call is a conversation happening with the president of Ukraine as well as President Trump. The president of Ukraine asks for more weapons, missiles, javelins. The president interrupts his ask and says, though, we would like you to look into something. Do us a favor. That is a quid pro quo. That right there is essentially him asking for something in return. And it is illegal, and it's beneath the president, the presidency, to be acting in that way, besides the legality of it.
Weigh principle with pragmatism for us right now, because there are many Democrats who think that, who have obviously despised President Trump for the entire course of his administration, and this has just added to it, the situation with Ukraine. But weigh this for me in terms of the, frankly, not even getting into the political risk. I don't want to get into that yet, but from the standpoint of, if you think he's doing the wrong things, does that put Democrats on a different slope as well to be able to rise above it? What are some of the pitfalls in this? Again, I don't mean politically, but pitfalls in terms of perception, at least.
Well, the pitfall is that we do not hold this president accountable, and this president continues to act in this manner and potentially going back to his best friend's Russia and getting help. Let's be clear, this is the second time he's asked for foreign interference in the election. And this call occurred the day after the Mueller testimony. So he has not learned his lesson. He has surrounded himself by a bunch of yes men and yes women that are not penning him in. And more importantly, for the sake of this country, going into the future, presidents need to know that they cannot act this way, whether a Democrat or Republican. So while the Republican Party is going to stay there and go down with Donald Trump, we're going to take our responsibilities under the Constitution seriously. And if there is political fallout, then that just may have to happen. But we're certainly not going to allow the executive to continue to abuse the process and conduct high crimes and misdemeanors under our nose without any consequences.
Let me ask you about the timing of this. I'm curious why you think that Speaker Pelosi made this announcement when she did, given that the transcript was coming out today, and we understand that the Director of National Intelligence is going to be coming before a couple of congressional committees later in the week to discuss this, and the actual Inspector General complaint may well be coming out this week as well. Why not wait until all of those things have come out before announcing this inquiry?
Because the president basically admitted to his crime. He actually talked about it on the news and said that he did, in fact, talk to the president of Ukraine and did, in fact, ask for help. There's nothing more impeachable than the president's own words. And, of course, now we see, and by the way, it's not a transcript, we see the memo that came out, but even the president's memo, it shows that he has done impeachable offenses. So, I think there is some type of yearning, I think, within the media world that we have to build this case. The case is there. The president admitted to a crime. Rudy Giuliani admitted to a crime. I don't think what else we need anything else. I think what the media wants is the President Trump to basically say, yes, I committed a crime. Please arrest me. That's not going to happen. We have to look at what is happening at its face value. And that's why what he's doing is impeachable.
All right. We'll have to leave it right there. That's Congressman Ruben Gallego of Phoenix. Congressman, thanks for your time.
Thank you for your time.
Gun control activists are holding a rally to end gun violence in Washington, D.C. this afternoon. The coalition includes March for Our Lives, Newtown Action Alliance, Amnesty International, and dozens of other groups. Demonstrating in solidarity with them in Phoenix is Jacob Martinez of Arizonans for Gun Safety. March for Our Lives Arizona will be at the Release the Fear statue in downtown Phoenix at 5:30. And the group's calling for universal background checks, red flag laws, and safe storage laws. Jacob, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So describe some of the policy changes that you and the group are calling for.
Well, first and foremost is universal background checks. Without background checks at every point of sale for weapons in the state and in the country, it virtually just invalidates the rest of our laws because there's no accountability. You could be a law-abiding citizen and you're selling a gun to me, and I could have the worst intentions in the world, but you're just following what you have to do. And without that proper step, we can't really ensure that gun sales are going to be properly done and properly, safely executed in the state.
Have you seen any progress to this point since you've become an activist on this issue? And if not, how does that make you feel?
Well, over the last year, I mean, we live in the most gun-friendly state in the country. And so while it's difficult to see any sort of progress, especially at the legislature or with the governor, we definitely do see nationally and with individuals, their opinions swing. Since we started doing this last March after the shooting in Parkland, we've just seen countless more examples like in El Paso and in Dayton where it just keeps happening. And so I think slowly but surely, until we get the change that is needed, we're going to have to go through this stuff, but it's changing the conversation. People are sick and tired of seeing, turning on the news and seeing mass shootings. We had 3 mass shootings in a matter of a week in this country, and that really exhibits the problems that are happening and the change that needs to be done.
Do you think that change is more likely to come on the federal level or the state level here in Arizona?
I think when it comes to the gun safety issue, the change hopefully is going to have to come at the federal level. We saw a great bill, H.R. 8, passed last February or this past February, which would have implemented universal background checks across the country. It's on the Senate now to take up that bill and President Trump to sign it. Here in Arizona, we're going to push for the same bill because, you never know what could happen. We're going to continue to push some other stuff like red flag laws and safe storage laws because those go hand in hand with background checks and ensuring that, we can eradicate threats as they as they manifest themselves, and we can ensure that children don't have access to guns, and parents will be held liable if their kid is to get their weapon and commit a crime.
What do you make of what Governor Ducey has done in this issue, his leadership, or how you perceive that?
Well, Governor Ducey, when, trying to craft a bill, brought in, people from the NRA and the CDL. And in my opinion, those aren't people that should be crafting a gun safety legislation plan. I think that the governor, he's talked so many times that we're bringing the stakeholders to the table. But none of the, gun violence prevention activists, youth activists, people that are actually in schools that have to face this issue every day, have ever spoken with the governor. We've never, you know, had any sort of seat at the table. And I think it's really important if the governor wants to craft legislation that's going to reflect the concerns and needs of students, he needs to bring some of these students to the table. And right now he's just not doing that.
And Jacob, briefly, what does Arizona's for Gun Safety plan to do next after tonight?
So this upcoming legislative session, there's a bill that's going to be pushed through the legislature. Hopefully it's, you know, it's already has bipartisan support. So hopefully it has the potential to go somewhere. It's just going to be on, you know, Republicans to be interested and actually want to take a stand, especially in committee, because it's super hard to get it through that. And then on Governor Ducey to sign it into law.
Jacob Martinez of Arizona's for Gun Safety. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much.
And now let's turn to a state lawmaker who has personal experience with gun violence.
Nearly 15 years ago, I was shot and paralyzed in a random shooting. And at the same time, my fiance was shot and has a significant head injury. And that was when I learned how significant an issue gun violence is in our nation.
That's Democratic State Representative Jennifer Longden, who now uses a wheelchair as a result of that random shooting. She'll be testifying on Capitol Hill tomorrow in front of the U.S. House Ways and Means Oversight Subcommittee on the public health consequences and costs of gun violence. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
I've been very involved nationally in gun violence prevention and disability rights, and that comes directly out of my own experience as a survivor of gun violence and a person with disability. And as I have become more and more active, I've had more opportunities to expand my role nationally and working on these issues.
So you'll tell this committee, I'm assuming, some of your own story and how it's impacted your own life. But I'm sure that you're also there to talk about the broader picture in terms of gun violence in this country. Where do you see it?
Well, we've been working on this for a very long time, and there is a good deal of data that tells us how much gun violence costs us every day in the nation. Here in Arizona alone, we spend $1.9 billion annually in direct cost as a result of gun violence. So there's going to be a lot of great testimony on facts and figures and statistics. But for me, what's most important isn't what fits on a ledger or in a spreadsheet, but the costs that we pay in pain and grief and loss.
Give us a sense of that. Like, I'm sure you hear from other victims of gun violence often.
I know thousands of survivors of gun violence personally as a result of the work that I've done. And every one of them has an incredible story to tell about what it means to have an empty chair at the dinner table, what it means to walk down the aisle without their parent or their sibling there, what it means to watch friends and family celebrate births and weddings and graduations knowing that their own child is now frozen in time at the age of 6 or 12 or 18. And then those of us who survive live with almost incalculable costs in terms of pain and adjustments and continuing treatments and therapies.
So let's talk about solutions. I mean, there's a lot bandied about in the political realm in terms of legislation that should be put forth. What are you advocating for?
On the national level, the first thing I'd like to see us do is untie the CDC's hands so that they can legally collect the data. They are prohibited from significantly collecting data. And for example, with motor vehicle accidents, when we started collecting data on road conditions and tires and quality of light and speeds and all of these kind of issues, we changed traffic fatalities with that data. And so we need data on gun violence, first of all. I believe that we should have comprehensive background checks so that we know who it is that owns a firearm. I'd like us to continue to look at a lot of other issues. I have some things here at the state level that I'll be introducing in January, and I'm still working on putting those proposals together for legislative session.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I mean, that's not the first answer I would expect you to say. It sounds like you're looking at this in a pragmatic way also, like what can politically be accomplished right now?
Well, I think that there are pragmatic and common sense answers to gun violence. And I think it starts with data and by putting some common sense regulations around when and how firearms are obtained, carried, stored, that sort of thing.
We just heard on the show from one of the students with the local chapter of March for Our Lives. These are, you know, young people working for an end to gun violence in response to the school shootings that we continue to see in this country. Do you think that this is a cause that is going to continue to pick up steam and the conversation around this will be different in a generation?
Oh, I believe that there will be a generational difference on the issue of gun violence. Children growing up now, young people who are now just beginning to vote, are members of what we call the Columbine generation. These are students who grew up with lockdown drills, who grew up in a world where gun violence could happen in their schools. Many of these young people, when you talk to them, they have written wills about what to do with their new bicycle or their new gaming system or whatever else, or what they want their brothers and sisters to have when they are killed in gun violence at their school. Our children should not have to be that brave or that frightened. And we need to be as brave as they are and institute these legislative changes now to protect them.
All right, that's State Representative Jennifer Longden. She will be testifying before the U.S. House Ways and Means Oversight Subcommittee on the Public Health Consequences and Costs of Gun Violence tomorrow. Representative Longden, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Lauren.
In 2018, a federal judge fined Arizona $1.4 million for poor health care conditions in Arizona prisons. The judge had warned the state after years of litigating the Parsons versus Ryan prison health care settlement that such fines were imminent if the Department of Corrections kept failing basic performance benchmarks. In oral arguments before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Tuesday, the state challenged the validity of that fine and asked a three-judge panel to throw it out. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins was in the courtroom and joins us now from San Francisco. Jimmy, how did we get to this point at the federal appeals level with this settlement?
Well, Steve, as you know, we are a long way away from the beginning of this story now, but more than 7 years ago, a group of inmates in state prisons formed a class action demanding better health care, and the state agreed to certain conditions to make things better in 2014. But since then, it's been a real fight. Over the past 3 years, I've watched the state pretty much challenge the inmates and their attorneys at every level. And so on Tuesday, we had what was the latest appeal to the most significant fine in the settlement process so far. Attorney Timothy Berg started things off for the state, but right as he got going, Steve, Judge Consuelo Callahan cut him off.
Okay, so we've already worn out one magistrate judge, and now we're on to Judge Silver, and then we're back with us. So how many more times do we get to see everyone?
Hopefully, Your Honor, not many more times.
And Steve, what Judge Callahan is needling him about there is very similar to what plaintiff attorneys have been saying for years. Basically, how long are we going to keep doing this?
And Jimmy, that means continuing with the legal challenges.
Yeah, instead of just complying with these orders, complying with the rules that both parties agreed to, the state keeps challenging the rulings, appealing the orders, and all the while, healthcare conditions are staying the same or getting worse. And in some cases, yes, people are dying.
So when the state was allowed to get back on track, what is the core argument they're making about the fine?
The state is saying that the district court judge was overseeing something called a stipulation, not a court order, not a consent decree. And that's important, they say, because that does give a judge power to hold the state in contempt and levy this fine against them, whereas they're saying the stipulation does not give him that power. An attorney for the inmates, Corrine Kendrick, argued that the judge was actually within his scope of judicial authority, and moreover, this fine was a long time coming.
The district court did not abuse its discretion when it issued the order to show cause, the civil contempt order, and sanctioned the defendants. The contempt order came after years of orders finding defendants substantially noncompliant, orders directing them to implement and develop remedial plans, defendants escalating disregard for the court's order.
So, Jimmy, what was your take on this panel of judges' reaction? And was there a way to read whether they were interested in one side's arguments more than the other?
Based on the questions that were asked, it seemed to me like at least two of the judges thought the lower court had the power to hold the state in contempt. The parties argued another appeal over court fees. To me, the judges seemed more interested in this challenge. Basically, the state is saying the attorneys for the inmates claimed fees for work they were doing that they shouldn't be able to claim. And the judges asked the plaintiff attorney several questions about whether or not the fees were justified. And one judge, he actually said, you know, I have concerns about the lower court ruling on that appeal.
So if the state loses, then the state's going to have to pay that big $1.4 million fine you mentioned.
That's right. And we'll let you know as soon as that ruling comes down. And in the meantime, Steve, I think it's worth noting that this case is already incredibly costly. ADC told me just last week that after 7 years of litigation, the state has already paid more than $19 million on Parsons. So this settlement is nowhere near over, and it looks like the state is not going to stop. It's going to keep up its legal challenges.
And that's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins in San Francisco, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Jimmy, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve.
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich has asked the state Supreme Court to reverse a decades-old ruling, which would give him more leeway in lawsuits he's allowed to file. In this case, Brnovich has sued the State Board of Regents, arguing tuition at the state's public universities is unconstitutionally high. But lower courts have ruled the AG cannot bring the lawsuit because he doesn't have the permission of the legislature or governor. That stems from a 1960 ruling that's become known as the McFate case and limits the power of the Attorney General to act independently. Bo Roysden is an attorney in the AG's office.
Like most states, Arizona has an independent elected Attorney General. And part of that job is to be responsible to the people. So if the Attorney General sees a violation of law, whether it be by a private business or by a state agency, it's important that the Attorney General, as the people's lawyer, can go to court and have the court rule on whether there is, in fact, a violation of the law.
In ruling against Brnovich's right to sue in the tuition case, three appeals court judges indicated they disagree with the McFate ruling. Former Attorney General Terry Goddard, a Democrat, agrees, telling us last month he thinks it's bad law.
And what the Court of Appeals did was they basically wrote a brief as a concurring opinion, which says McFate is a terrible decision. It's time we got rid of it. Supreme Court, pay attention. And I think that was an actual textbook for the Attorney General to say to the Supreme Court, here it is for you. Your decision has been written. McFate has been screwing up our constitutional system in Arizona for many years. Let's have a clean slate and let the AG be what he should be, the attorney for the people.
But the opinions of the current and a former attorney general on this issue are not universally shared. With me for a dissenting view is Tom Collins, executive director of the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission. And Tom, why do you think the ruling limiting who the AG can sue should stand?
Well, I think it has two problems. One is a policy problem and one is a process problem. The policy problem is that most state agencies, except for the electeds, report to the governor. And as a result of that, if the attorney general asserts that he or she represents the interests of the state and uses that interest to sue another agency, he or she is more than likely suing someone who is reliant upon the attorney general's office for advice and compliance and defense. There are a vast number of statutes that create vast powers for the Attorney General. All of these have been set forth by the legislature. And that gets to the process problem. For 60 years, attorneys general, whether they liked it or not, have operated under the statute that McFate, I believe, correctly construed. So given that the Attorney General's powers are set at law, given that I don't think anyone disputes the legislature with the governor's signature has the authority to adjust those, I think the Arizona Supreme Court is the wrong venue to do that.
The AG should go to the legislature.
I think that would be a wiser course.
Let me ask you about the policy problems that you outlined. And unlike in the federal government, where the president appoints an attorney general, in Arizona, the AG is elected by themselves statewide, a duly elected official, constitutional officer. Why should they have to get the permission of the governor and the legislature to do their job? They're just as elected as anybody else.
Well, I think the Constitution is clear on that. I don't think anyone disputes that the Constitution sets forth the Attorney General has such powers that are set forth by law. And the case, the McFate case, says that. And if you look at the powers that the legislature and the governor have given to the Attorney General, they include vast powers to ensure that fraud, that crime, that illegitimate office holders, all of these things are within the Attorney General's power already. So to expand it to simply what amounts to a disagreement about a particular agency's policy decisions has very little to do with the structure of the Constitution and the Attorney General's role as decided by the legislature.
It sounds like what you're saying is if there is a concern about, for example, in this case, tuition at the state's universities being too high, a student could file suit or some other entity, legal entity, could file suit, just not the Attorney General.
I think that's fair. In fact, the precedent that on the merits the Attorney General is attempting to distinguish to suggest that their formula is not consistent with the as nearly free as possible command of the state constitution was in fact brought by students and a private lawyer.
You work for an agency, a state agency. If this decision is reversed, could that affect the Clean Elections Commission?
Well, I certainly hope not. And, you know, we have very good relationship with the attorneys who work with us. We have always had. But despite the fact that the commission is well respected in the state, those have never been free from controversy. So if one were to decide we disagree with X policy, yes, there's a risk there. And, you know, I certainly hope that that wouldn't happen. I don't have any anticipation of it, but it is the kind of thing that for an agency like ours raises our concerns sooner than it raises other agencies' concerns.
If the Supreme Court overturns this decision and does give the Attorney General the power that he is pursuing here, what do you think the effect would be overall?
I think the risk is that there will be more, not less, litigation among state agencies. Now, I recognize that in the majority of states, the Attorney General has been given the power to act as a more of a freelance watchdog. In Arizona, as I've said, the legislature has given the Attorney General express authority in law to play that role under a variety of circumstances. Since the Attorney General already has those powers, it's not clear to me what additional power would be here other than the power to turn policy disputes into legal disputes. And now the taxpayers of Arizona would be paying two sets of lawyers to litigate a question that ought to be settled by the legislature, subject to suit by other people who may have standing.
All right. That's Tom Collins, Executive Director of the Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission. Tom, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ. With Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Still to come, Arizonans may have a new state where they can apply to get a medical marijuana license.
State lawmakers are expected to tackle criminal justice reform next session, but what information should they use to guide their policies? Next hour, a state agency that tracks and evaluates criminal justice policies is holding a hearing to determine what information can reliably be used for proposed reforms. Andrew Lefevre is executive director of the Arizona Criminal Justice Commission, and he is with me. Andrew, let's begin with some expectations for today's session. What will attendees be discussing and looking into?
Steve, well, you know, one of the things we heard over and over again last legislative session as we were meeting with legislators and policymakers was a general question around, hey, I've got three, four, five different reports that all seem to be looking at the same data and different results, and I don't know which one to believe. What should we? How do you help us out? Help us do that. So the commission, as a body that was created by the legislature in 1982, one of our statutory functions is to review criminal justice policy issues and provide reports back to the governor and the legislature. So we're building on that that mandate. The commission is going to begin holding a series of hearings on criminal justice reform topics. The goal of that being report outs to the legislature and the governor afterwards that will hopefully help them make data-driven decisions on policy issues. So this first hearing that we're holding is really going to just be looking at what data sources are out there and available in the data that's contained in them so that we can try and create what we're calling a common data framework to look at. So that if a legislator wants to put a bill in that's going to change something from X to Y, we can put it in that lens and say that we'll do this. And then hopefully everybody will say that seems to be a good way to look at the data. Let's go ahead and do that. And then we get rid of these competing narratives. And I think that's what legislators and policymakers were finding frustrating.
Are there certain data categories you can share with me that you think everyone can at least agree on that these are the most important ones to look at?
Well, the ones we're definitely looking at are, obviously, the Department of Corrections is going to present on their data and how they collect and house their data at from the Department of Corrections. We're also going to be hearing from the Administrative Office of the Courts. So the courts collect a lot of data, obviously, on that's going on. And that's not just information around sentencing. That's also the probation system. So, again, another big leg of those folks that are involved in our criminal justice system. Then my agency is going to present on the Arizona Computerized Criminal History System, which is an electronic database that was created that contains all felonies, and that's what we use to search when people do background checks. So that contains all arrests and convictions and dispositions in it. So it's a data set most folks don't have access to, so we're going to look at that. We're also going to look a little bit at some of the federal reports that are out there. Again, those collect information from states, but you know, how are they collecting it and that? And then, you know, again, we'll come out of this report probably with some direction from our members about, okay, great, we heard some things, we asked some questions, go back, look at these things in a certain way, and come back to us with a report out that we can then review and then hopefully provide to the governor and the legislature. We're also going to have time for public comment at these hearings. We want to make sure that if a group has looked at something in a way that we haven't thought of or a unique way, we want to hear about the way they did it. We don't want to necessarily talk about whether their findings are right or wrong, but tell us about how you went about collecting your data so we can say, is that something we should add into this framework?
Considering it almost feels like a perfect storm to some extent around the country as far as at least looking into what criminal justice reform would look like, how does it feel to actually be involved in this process at the point where Arizona may be making steps like this? Do you think it can be really impactful at this point?
It is. I mean, we are at a point in time where we collect all of this data. You know, we live in a world of silos sometimes, and it's how do we break those down? You know, how do we put stuff together so we get an accurate picture? You know, how do we combat narratives that are out there? Because there's a narrative on each side of every issue that, you know, it just makes it very difficult. And you know, hearing stories about this, that, or the other thing is a great way to get a personalized story on something, but is it an accurate story? You know, Arizona is different than California, is different than Maine, is different than Florida. Not saying that some of the trends aren't the same, but our system operates differently here because we are able as a state to pass our own laws. So, you know, one of the things that I think the legislators and policymakers were finding difficult to navigate was, you know, all of these groups from coming in from around the country with, you know, their narrative of what they want to see happen, and with good reason or with good intent. But again, how do we know that the way they've looked at that data is accurate for Arizona? That's what I think we're hoping to get out of this first report or this first hearing that we're holding. And again, after this, then we will probably begin to identify some specific topics that we want to look at going forward. You know, invite the folks in that can talk accurately about those topics and then come out of that again with a report out that we can make to the legislature and the governor. You know, we'll have two of these at least this fall, so we'll have some basis to start out with beginning the legislative session. And, you know, if these go as well as our commission members are hoping they are, we'll probably do these going forward into next year and really do a comprehensive look at some major issues to bring a report back to the governor and the legislature before the 2021 session.
So can I use the old pat phrase, lies, damn lies, statistics? We know that statistics and data can be used. So how confident do you feel, how comfortable that there will be a data set that, again, not based on partisanship or narratives, but just based on really getting the facts that people need?
I feel confident that we will be able to arrive at something that our body, as it meets, will say this is the way we should do it. Now, again, whether everyone is going to agree with that or not, I don't know. You know, it's easy to, you know, I was looking at a report the other day that we had pulled in my office, and, you know, they said, oh, we looked at a data set that was from, I forget, it was like 2006 to 16 was the data set, but then every other chart had a different starting year or ending year. And it's like, well, Yeah, if you do that, it's easy to tell the story you want to tell. So, you know, if we can arrive at we're going to look at a 15-year window of that's every set's going to be that same 15 years, and we're going to pull it fiscal year or calendar year or however we decide mm-hmm. to do it, then at least then you can begin to build data sets from that, that hopefully when you put them together, everybody will be at least playing off the same sheet of music.
Andrew Lefevre, Director of the Arizona Criminal Justice Commission. Good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Arizonans may have a new way to get medical marijuana. Go to New Mexico. A judge there has ruled the state must open up its medical cannabis program to residents of other states. That's after three out-of-staters, including from Arizona, sued over the issue. Joining me to talk more about this is Dan Boyd, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Albuquerque Journal. And Dan, this case seems to be about who is eligible to take part in New Mexico's medical marijuana program. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Kind of just as background, this kind of stems from a change in law, a bill that was drafted and approved during this year's legislative session that made a lot of changes to the medical marijuana program. But among those changes were it changed the definition of a patient under the program, in part by deleting a requirement that a patient be a New Mexico resident. The state agency that runs the program has said that part was a drafting error, and that wasn't intended to kind of open up the program to out-of-state residents, but they were then challenged in court, and that's kind of led to the whole legal situation.
Does it seem as though that was really a drafting error, or does it seem as though the folks who drafted that bill that became law really meant to open it up?
Well, certainly, certainly it seems when you read the statute, you know, in its new form, you know, it does seem clearly that whether that was intended or not, that it did remove that requirement. So either someone kind of snuck that in, or somebody just it was an oversight and they didn't catch it. I'm not honestly sure which one of the two, but it has had an impact, and it could have a large impact moving forward.
Are there particular conditions for which somebody in New Mexico can get a recommendation for medical marijuana?
There are 28 different conditions, actually, that the state added a few additional conditions earlier this year. The most popular, or I guess widely used, I should say, conditions are post-traumatic stress disorder and severe chronic pain. Even just with only New Mexico residents, the program's been growing in recent years. It's currently about 77,000 patients that are enrolled. And we're not talking about a highly populated state here, about 2 million people living in New Mexico.
So you mentioned that the new law does, whether it was intentional or not, does take out the requirement that somebody be a New Mexico resident. It seems like that's what the judge in this case was looking at, right? Saying that, in fact, what the law says is that you do not have to be a resident of New Mexico to take part in that state's program.
Exactly. That's what the judge has ruled. He had an initial ruling, and then just this week he kind of reaffirmed that. Basically, he found that, that there's not ambiguity in that new statute, in his mind, that it's clear that the state should start issuing these medical cannabis identification cards to residents from other states as long as they qualify, meet one of those qualifying conditions. So basically where we're at now is they're kind of under a court order to start issuing ID cards to folks from Arizona, Texas, other states that qualify. The department has said it plans to appeal the ruling to the Court of Appeals, so it may not be a done deal, though, quite yet.
What are political leaders in New Mexico saying about this ruling? I'm especially curious about people who support the state's medical marijuana program. I'm wondering if they're enthusiastic about opening it up or if they're maybe thinking, okay, we need to go back into the law and fix this.
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. I think there are some producers, medical cannabis producers, who see this as commercially as a big opportunity for, kind of opening up the program to a lot more additional participants, which could have some financial benefits for them. But I think there's also concerns that doing that would put a lot of strain on the program. Already there's been a plant count on producers, how much mature plants they can have, that has already come under some scrutiny. And interestingly, this is all playing out as well, kind of while the state is debating whether or not to legalize recreational marijuana use, kind of a separate but related issue that the governor here has said she'll put on the agenda for next year's legislative session. So a lot of different kind of implications and possible consequences of this.
You mentioned that the program has been growing pretty rapidly just among New Mexicans. Is there any
estimate as far as how much it might grow if Arizonans, Texans, other residents of other states are able to take part as well?
Yeah, there, actually, the Department of Health, the secretary of that department, in an affidavit said she thinks the program could more than double under that scenario, you know, could grow by an additional 100,000 individuals, which, you know, would be a significant increase, would more than double the program, actually. I'm not exactly sure how they arrived at that number, but certainly they've looked at kind of the population in both Arizona and Texas, kind of, you know, that live in a pretty close proximity to New Mexico and could feasibly make a pretty short trip to get medical cannabis if that were to be allowed.
All right. That's Dan Boyd. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Albuquerque Journal based in Santa Fe. Dan, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, thanks so much for having me on.
The photographic collection at the Arizona State Museum has images in it that date back as long as cameras have been around. Many of them are photographs of Native Americans taken mostly by archaeologists and anthropologists from as early as the late 1800s. At least a third of the collection was shot by state photographer Helga Tiwas, according to Janelle Weekly, who manages the collection.
And she would go out and visit different communities and document basket weaving, pottery making, agricultural practices, you name it.
The collection just received American Treasure status, which means it now has dedicated funding to preserve and protect these delicate collections. And as Weekly told our co-host Lauren Gilger, the collection is not just about the photographs themselves. It's about preserving records of the history of this region.
Our museum has all sorts of objects, pottery, basketry, jewelry, and then archaeological objects too. And they're all meaningless or have less meaning if we don't understand the context in which things were found or have a document of who made the object. And so we have photographs of the basket weavers, the pottery makers, the jewelers. We also have photographs of where the objects were found as the archaeologists were excavating. And those photographs, those documents give meaning to the objects.
So it all kind of goes hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like not only do these photos capture some of tribal history here in the Southwest, but they also capture a moment in time when Native Americans were sort of romanticized, when their photographers out sort of documenting their lives in that way. What do you think in terms of looking back at the context in which these photos are taken? Like, did they say as much about the photographers as they do about the subjects?
Oh, yeah. One of the more interesting collections we have is the work of Foreman Hanna, and he was a photographer, avocational photographer, and a pharmacist in Globe, Arizona. And he took many, many photos. He was very interested in the romantic view of Native peoples in the Southwest, not just the people, but also the landscapes and the buildings. It's pretty fascinating to look at his work. And he would send his work out to salons around the internationally, and he was accepted into many, many galleries and museums, and they exhibited his work. So we have almost all of his art prints, and we also have all of his negatives. And his work is a very romantic view of tribal communities around Arizona and New Mexico. And it's pictorialism, there's soft focus, and it says a lot about him.
So I know that there were periods in history when many tribes sort of rejected photography, right, and didn't want to be a part of that. How do tribal communities view these images now in terms of documenting their history or allowing them to connect with their past? Is it viewed in a negative way sometimes, or is it something that they're appreciative of?
My experiences run the gamut. Mostly it's on the positive side. For example, the Yaqui History Club from Pascua Yaqui comes about once a year, and I pull as many photographs as we can look at, and we sit around the table and pass around photographs, and it's a tremendous experience. The people that get to view these, they know that it's their ancestors, or they'll say, oh, that's my auntie, or that's my great-grandmother, and it's an emotional experience for everybody. There's laughter and tears, and it's usually quite a lot of fun. And mostly my experience has been people are very appreciative that we have these photographs and that they're available for anybody to come look at, and they want us to preserve them.
So last question for you then. How do you see these photos as, I guess, looking back at the past, but also giving us a roadmap forward? Like, what do you think is important about preserving history in this way?
I think contemporary society often tries to keep indigenous members stuck in the past, and they only view them as if they're these old black and white photographs that Curtis took or Foreman Hanna took. And what we can show is how cultures have changed and how have traditions have somewhat stayed the same and also have changed, and how people are living contemporary lives in each time. They're not stuck in a past, and I think that's significant. It also shows a connection to place, and that one of the things I think we also forget being contemporary people is that this place, the people who are indigenous people in Arizona, we're here far longer than any of us imports. And I think it's, we can show that in this collection. We can show that deep, long connection to place.
All right. That's Janelle Weekly, manager of the Arizona State Museum's photographic collections. Janelle, thank you for coming on the show to tell us about this.
Sure, thank you.
And Steve, speaking of photos, which if I had a photo of you right now, I would notice that you look brighter-eyed than you might otherwise.
Okay, well, that can mean a lot of different things. What does it mean?
Well, I would have imagined you would have stayed up to watch the longest game ever at Chase Field, the second longest, in fact, in franchise history.
Well, you and I get up early, so I burned out after about 10 innings, but it was a record-breaking game. It lasted 19, Mark. So when I went to bed, the game had been going for about 3.5 hours, and it went
so
another 3.5 hours
after that. Yeah.
Second baseman Ildemar Vargas hit a bases-loaded single that clinched victory for the Diamondbacks against the Cardinals. Final score was 3-2. Here is that history-making moment.
Ball game. Good night, everybody. Ildemar Vargas tied it in the ninth and wins it in the 19th. What a ball game.
Well, he sounds a little hoarse there. I can't imagine why. Fans, as you could hear, still in the stands until the end, 6 hours and 53 minutes after that game began. That does not help the Major League Baseball's pace of play initiative, does it?
And not the best Diamondback season ever. And you kind of wonder, an amazing game for us to talk about, but wow. Imagine,
That's so long.
It doesn't really even matter in the standings. They played for 7 hours.
19 innings.
But it's only a game, as an NPR show would say. Right?
Free baseball.
Yep.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.